Chapter 1. Conspiracy erupts. I wanted this conspiracy to come to the surface, and it has. Mary Baker Eddy, 1885. Caroline Bates was far from jubilant as she made her way to the artist's studio on a July day which she was never to forget. Her mission was a sad one, for though her father, Henry Bradley, M.D., was a fine physician, neither he nor his colleagues had been able to effect a cure in Mrs. Bates' case. So by the summer of 1885, she had reconciled herself to an early death. The visit to the artist was to obtain a crayon portrait of herself, a special gift for her husband, before their final parting. But that was not the gift she brought home to him that memorable afternoon. Little did Caroline dream that her whole life would be transformed in a few short hours. For while in the studio, she was given a book to read, entitled Science and Health, with the suggestion that in her circumstances she would find it a great help. And wonder of wonders, the little she read brought about an immediate and permanent healing after all the long years of suffering. A wife restored to health and the joy of a wondrous new discovery eclipsed the portrait. Edward P. Bates accepted Christian Science as eagerly and readily as had his wife, and both became serious students. Caroline's parents were so impressed by her miraculous healing that they too began the study of Christian Science. A year and a half later, the primary class that convened at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, January 10, 1887, included Dr. and Mrs. Henry Ives Bradley and Mr. and Mrs. Edward P. Bates. Following the course, Dr. Bradley returned to his home in New Haven, Connecticut, abandoned his medical practice, and became a Christian Science practitioner. In the fall, on October 30, 1887, Mr. and Mrs. Bates began a second course of instruction at the Metaphysical College, the normal course of instruction. Graduates of Mary Baker Eddy's classes were members of the Christian Scientist Association, CSA, which met regularly in Boston, but local students were the only regular attendants. Being residents of Syracuse, New York, the Bateses may not have been present at the rebellious meetings in the spring of 1888. However, if at all possible, these appreciative students surely responded to their teacher's call to meet in Chicago, for the leader had written in the Christian Science Journal, quote, "Let no consideration bend or outweigh your purpose to be in Chicago on June 13th, end quote. While Mrs. Eddy was unifying her great cause at the meeting of the National Christian Science Association in Chicago, the dissidents were not idle. The rebellious faction in Boston was doing all in its power to wrest control of the CSA from the discoverer. This original and smaller association consisted only of those students who had been personally taught by Mrs. Eddy. But sad to say, many of those early students could not follow their leader's spiritual footsteps. The self-justification of materiality against spiritual demands caused them to react violently against her leadership. When Mrs. Eddy returned to Boston, she found that in her absence, this rebellious faction had called a special meeting on the 12th of June with the intent of expelling her from her own college association. They had, through deceit, obtained the association records while the secretary was in Chicago. And though they had failed to control the meeting completely to the point of ousting Mrs. Eddy, a large contingent led by the vice president, Sarah H. Cross, withdrew membership, walked out, taking the records with them, and left the association in a shambles. 34 members, including most of the oldest and most prominent practitioners in the Boston area, severed their relationship with the CSA and formed an active resistance to the activities of the remaining loyal students. Having experienced litigation with Edward Ahrens in the 1870s, Mrs. Eddy immediately took steps to protect the association funds. Her next step was an endeavor to air the complaints, and to that end, she called a special meeting. The notice which was sent to all members in the New England and Middle States by the association secretary, William B. Johnson, read in part, Boston, June 22nd, 1888. You are hereby requested to attend a special meeting of the CS Association to be holden at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, Wednesday, June 27th at 2 p.m., called for the following purpose: to give certain members opportunity to comply with the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, and the Bylaws on Fellowship, Section 1, namely, quote, if they have aught against other members, it shall be their duty to faithfully tell them of it, end quote. Our self-sacrificing teacher, Mrs. Eddy, says, quote, I have no conception of what some members of the association are hinting at against me, and I will be present on the 27th to hear what they have to say. Self-conscious of my own integrity in all things, I call on the members of our association who have aught against me to tell me of it, even though they have broken this rule of the Church of Christ and the commandments of God by not first having told their brother his fault. I will give them another opportunity to deal justly. End quote. Attendance at the meeting was large, with members coming from New York, Philadelphia, and Providence, as well as from all over Massachusetts. But not one of the dissenters showed up. Mr. Johnson was devastated, for he had worked endless hours, day after day, endeavoring to contact all parties in an effort at reconciliation. The leader, too, had endeavored to open the students' eyes to the animal magnetism that was using them. In the notification for the meeting, she had said, I have earnestly counseled my students not to be guilty of this great wrong, which has caused much discord. I have set them a different example and told them first their faults and avoided telling them to others. I will now give them one more opportunity to deal justly, and I will listen patiently and charitably to all they have to say against me, and in return will ask only this, that those who have freely spoken of their great obligations to me will now be simply just to me. After learning a little even of the good I have achieved, and which has demanded and been associated with all of my movements since God commissioned me to bring Christian Science into this world of iniquity, they will learn how to estimate its value instead of traducing it. I have no desire of retaining in the CSA those who, under the influence of animal magnetism and personal ambition, persist in hurting themselves and trying to hurt others. But my love for my enemies causes this desire to save them from committing a great sin. Also, I wanted this conspiracy to come to the surface, and it has. And now is the only time for us to meet in Christian love and adjust this great wrong done to one who has given all the best of her years to heal and bless the whole human family. A great majority of the people who call themselves Christians do not truly have Christian love in their hearts, but they are never tested on that issue, so they go on totally unaware of their shortcoming. The 27th of June in 1888 was a testing day for 34 men and women who had been professing and practicing their Christian faith for many years. They had healed many of sickness, but had made little effort at healing themselves of sin, i.e., at self-purification. So when the prince of this world came, it had found much in them to play upon. In later years, many would regret their actions. But on this June afternoon, it was the small remnant left in Boston that was sorrowful. As member after member arrived, it became obvious that those for whom the meeting had been called would not appear, and the early comers and staunchest workers had a sinking sense of despair. Mrs. Eddy spoke words of hope and inspiration to those present at the meeting, but she later confided sadly to a student, quote, "I do not believe I have 12 loyal students left," end quote. She was president of the association, but every other officer was a part of the rebellion, with the exception of the newly elected secretary, William B. Johnson. Mr. Johnson arrived home very late that evening, weary and worn. After trying to rest, he asked his son to read him some of David's appeals for divine help and something from the New Testament. When the lad turned to 1 John, he read the heading, quote, "A warning against false teachers," end quote. John's message was pertinent to this day. 19. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would no doubt have continued with us. But they went out, that they might be made manifest that they were not all of us. Mr. Johnson said, quote, "That is enough. I have my answer, and I am strong now," end quote. Then with difficulty, he continued, quote, "We may lose Mrs. Eddy," end quote. No, she was not ill. quote, "I have been with her for 3 hours since the close of the meeting, and she sees very little hope in Boston for her church. It may be that she will leave here and go to the West, but she does not want to give up her college. I know that our prayers will be answered and that she will obtain divine guidance before this terrible and heartbreaking day is finished." 5 men left. After the special meeting of June 27th, it was obvious that all of the most capable, successful, and affluent Christian Science workers in the Boston area had renounced the discoverer and founder. In assessing the depleted ranks, she could find only 5 men in Boston loyal to her and her cause, and willing to work for it rather than against it. These 5 were Hanover P. Smith, Irwin L. Coleman, William B. Johnson, Joseph S. Eastman, and Frank E. Mason. Hanover P. Smith had been a deaf mute the first 19 years of his life, until healed by Mrs. Eddy in 1880. From that time, he had devoted himself to Christian Science and was a good practitioner. But his gentle, loving nature was not well suited to the difficult tasks at hand. Janet Coleman had first come to Mrs. Eddy to study in 1883, and in the ensuing years, she and her husband, Irwin, had both become earnest workers. Mrs. Eddy liked Mr. Coleman's cleanness of character and his contagious, joyous spirit, but she was also aware that in his generous love for her, he did not always use caution in what he said. Since 1883, when William B. Johnson first studied science, his greatest struggle had been with poverty. But he was sincere and dependable, and gave his all to assist his leader. Because of this willingness on his part, Mrs. Eddy leaned heavily upon him at this time, and for many years afterward. She could always count upon him to follow her instructions to the very best of his ability. Captain Joseph S. Eastman was a first-rate good fellow. He had come to Mrs. Eddy for help for his wife in 1884 and remained to study and to practice. This retired sea captain's appreciation and love for Mrs. Eddy were unbounded, and he assisted his teacher in any way he could. Mrs. Eddy loved the captain dearly, and she appreciated his efforts, but she was not unaware of his limitations. Eastman's gratitude and fidelity exceeded his metaphysical understanding. And though he was a successful Christian Science practitioner, fearless and staunch, he was more the retired sea captain. He was also hampered by a language barrier, as English was not his native tongue. He wrote well, but he did not always speak fluently when warmed to his subject. Frank E. Mason had studied at the Metaphysical College in May of 1887. Since that time, he had shown considerable ability in writing and speaking on Christian Science, and Mrs. Eddy had chosen him often to fill the pulpit of her church. By May of 1888, he had been appointed assistant pastor and was residing at the college on Columbus Avenue. Mrs. Eddy recognized his ability and gave him every opportunity to use his good qualities. But with all his vigor and enthusiasm, he was at times explosive and unpredictable. In the 1880s, women were not accepted in the business world. Mrs. Eddy's work had made great strides toward equality of the sexes, but it was a battle. Men were needed in the ranks, and particularly in Mrs. Eddy's immediate circle, where there was so much work to be done. As she considered these five men, plus Calvin Fry, who was always at her side, she appreciated the loyalty of each and the work he was doing for the cause. But there was so much more to be done than six men could possibly accomplish. For a time, she considered leaving Boston, which was what William Johnson so greatly feared. And the logical choice, if she was to relocate, was the city she had termed the, quote, miracle of the Occident, end quote, Chicago. She had just written for the July Journal, quote, to loyal Christian Scientists, end quote, which stated, "You, my beloved students, who are absent from me and have shared less of my labors than many others, seems stronger to resist temptation than some of those who have had line upon line and precept upon precept. I have felt for some time that perpetual instruction of my students might substitute my own for their growth." Thus far, Chicago had been the, quote, wonder of the Western Hemisphere, end quote. But what assurance had she that it would not become as Boston, should she move there and give the students line upon line and precept upon precept? There were already indications of weakness in Chicago. The previous February, the Chicago church had requested that the journal remove the professional card of Reverend Joseph Adams. And just this month, the behavior of the pastor, Reverend George Day, in publicly announcing Mrs. Eddy as the main speaker at the convention, without consulting her or even notifying her, was certainly questionable. In addition, every Christian Scientist who could be reached had recently received an announcement from the Chicago area from Ursula N. Justefeld. Mrs. Justefeld had been in Mrs. Eddy's Chicago class in 1884, but unlike others in that class, she had not sought further teaching at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. Instead, she had mixed the science she had learned with spiritualism and theosophy, and on this mixed basis had authored a book to simplify Christian Science. Her circular stated that science and health, quote, is a book difficult of comprehension, and much patient study of it for many does not suffice for an understanding of its meaning, end quote. Her book, Statement of Christian Science, was just off the press, and she was advertising it as a key to science and health. No, Chicago was not the answer. But more men were needed in Boston if the movement was to go forward. The leader's thoughts turned to the pastor of the Chicago church, Reverend Day. He needed strengthening for better work for the cause. They turned, too, to Ira Knapp, who in the fall of 1885 had been revealed as the Peter in her experience, and also to the sincere young doctor, Ebenezer Foster, who had appeared at her door just last November.